Would you say that lying is always wrong? There are people out there who would. Immanuel Kant was of the opinion that it was never permitted under any circumstances. For what would happen if everyone did it, right? What if it were a universal law? In Game of Thrones, Jon Snow makes basically the same point. He refuses to tell a little white lie because otherwise words stop meaning anything. A slippery slope fallacy, I'd say. Most people are a little more flexible when it comes to lying. But what if this command, always tell the truth? What if you were convinced that that was given to you by a divine being? Well, that is not so hard to imagine either, is it? Thou shalt not lie is in the Ten Commandments, I believe. Yet even devout Christians, I'm sure, tell a lie now and then. Now, it helps if sins can be absolved afterwards, I guess. But what also helps, perhaps, is that nowadays most worldly authorities don't take lying all that seriously. I don't believe there is any place in the world where it is a capital crime, except perhaps in particular circumstances like under oath. But what if this were the case? What if you believed that God and truth are the same thing, that the devil and lies are the same thing? And what if your king declares a war on lying and seems to be extremely serious about it, how would that change things? Well, perhaps today we're gonna find out. We've talked earlier about the Zoroastrian belief, with Ahura Mazda, the Lord of Light, as the supreme deity. As we've seen, he is constantly battling the minions of the lie, and people have to make a choice to fight on either side. That state of affairs was revealed millennia ago by Ahura Mazda himself to his prophet Zarathustra, who went on to explain to the people around him that all the other gods were in fact demons. This happened at some undetermined point in the far past, somewhere in Central Asia, and we can speculate why, in such an environment, truth of all things would be considered the most divine thing. In a society that didn't write things down and that had few institutions to speak of, oaths would be crucial in stopping society from falling apart. If people could not trust the word of the other, if oaths stopped meaning anything, chaos indeed beckoned, literally. Under these conditions, the slope becomes more slippery, I guess. The Persians famously learned their youngsters three things: to write, to shoot, and to tell the truth. That says something about how they felt about liars. Perhaps it's no coincidence that as supreme deity, Zarathustra picked the Lord of Truth. Zoroastrianism would evolve for many centuries before it became state religion under the Sasanians, and it would continue to change after that too, needless to say. But already under the Achaemenids, an earlier version was used by the Persian state. It was not forced upon the population. Other gods were still venerated, even in the Persian heartland, but the King of Kings would propagate himself as the protector of truth. There is a giant rock facade in a place called Behistun, 50 foot high, 80 foot wide. It served as a giant billboard next to one of the busiest highways of the ancient world, between Babylon and Ecbatana. It was made on the orders of Darius the Great, or Dariavaush, the most powerful ruler of the world at the time. In no less than three languages, embellished with giant pictures, he tells us, well, his truth. First, he informs us about his lineage. His ancestor, he declares, was a certain Achaemenes, who also happens to be the forebearer of Cyrus the Great, founder of the Persian Empire. This is why the first Persian dynasty is still known as the Achaemenid dynasty. Darius then goes on to claim that eight of his dynasty were kings before him, but that it was by the grace of Ahura Mazda that he became king. He also informs us how this happened exactly. After the death of Cyrus, the crown would pass to his firstborn son Cambyses, while his other son Bardiya was given a semi-independent kingdom to rule in the east as a consolation prize of sorts, you might say. But Cambyses, or so Darius claims, had gone mad, and one day, in his rage, he killed his brother. But he didn't want that to become known, so he kept it a secret. Yet somehow this would become known to a devious mage called Gaumata. And when Cambyses was far away conquering Egypt, this impostor would see his chance. He would pretend to be the king's brother, taking advantage of the fact that no one knows what the prince actually looks like, apparently, and he starts a rebellion. The king gets ready to march home, but then suddenly he dies. His own death, as Darius mysteriously puts it. With Cambyses' death, of course, Bardia should become the new king. That was the arrangement. So Gaumata, pretending to be Bardia, can now lay claim to the throne. This, however, the brave Darius could not allow, and with a small group of high-born generals, he goes to assassinate Gaumata. In Behistun, Darius is presented with his foot on a figure who is identified as that false mage. Just above Darius flies a winged figure, representing Far, the divine blessing that Ahura Mazda bestowed on the rightful king. Before him are nine smaller figures, with their hands and necks tied together. Darius helpfully explains to us that these are all wannabe usurpers, who falsely claim to be rightful kings of their respective parts of the Persian Empire. He sums them all up in a similar fashion. For instance, next to a relief of one liar king, he writes, "This is Nidintubel. He lied, saying, 'I am Nebuchadnezzar, son of Nabonidus. I am king of Babylon.'" Then next to another such figure, he writes, "This is Ashina. He lied, saying, 'I am king of Elam,'" and so on and so forth. So reads the truth about Darius's rise to power, as told by the man himself, and he makes it very clear that Ahura Mazda has tasked him with rooting out whoever disputes the truth. A stark warning, impossible to miss. He even has some advice for those who become king after him, to punish harshly those that follow the lie. So what are we to make of this? To call it suspect is, of course, an understatement. To name just the obvious, how realistic is it, really, that Cambyses kills his brother, still the semi-independent ruler of a big region at the time, without anyone even noticing? Except, of course, this Gaumata figure, who happens to look just like him, or has made it so through magic or really good cosmetic surgery. That is too much to accept as fact, and probably even for people who did believe in magic, weren't exactly trained in critical thinking, and didn't have much information to make out what was happening in the world. That would explain why so many rose in revolt immediately after Darius's power grab. So it was probably not without reason that Darius made it clear that to openly contradict this would not just be treason, but also sacrilege. Remember last episode, when King Artaxerxes has someone put to death for denying his own fable about how he killed his brother single-handedly? Well, there was a precedent for that. To make denial of the official truth a capital crime, that's a wonderful way to make people accept your propaganda. And when it comes to that, the Persians were the undisputed masters of the ancient world. I think I can safely say that 100% of you are already convinced that Darius was himself lying when he ordered this inscription. But even then, you'll be surprised how little of this truth is actually true. Even the parts that sound harmless enough. Just to be clear, we can never know the whole truth for certain millennia after the fact, but historians have found ever more holes in this story, leaving almost nothing standing. Start with the origins. Darius claims that he came from a long line of kings. That is simply not true. He invents this pedigree out of thin air, with the sole purpose of having a common ancestor with Cyrus the Great. In reality, the founder of the Achaemenid Empire did not belong to the clan of the Achaemenids. It's no wonder that people long thought this to be the case, however, since at the site of Cyrus's tomb, there is an inscription that reads, "I am Cyrus, an Achaemenid." Well, if he says so himself. Turns out, though, that this was put there later, and more precisely, during the reign of Darius the Great. So he put words in Cyrus's mouth when he was no longer around to object. Deep fake need not be high tech, apparently. Historians could not figure this out until recently. So even the name of this dynasty is itself a convenient lie. Pretty ominous for an empire that would be ruled in the name of truth with a capital T. But Cyrus would have been ill-placed to object. He had been quite a storyteller himself, you see. In fact, his own rise to power, some historians now think, may have been rather similar to that of Darius the Great. We will now make a little flashback within this episode to the period just before the rise of Cyrus and the founding of the Persian Empire. For we can only determine to what extent Darius's account in the rock facade at Baistun was false if we examine what really happened in the period before that. I will try to tell this story the way that modern-day historians usually understand it, but be aware that they don't always see eye to eye. I think our story should begin with the fall of Assyria, a brutal empire that held much of the Middle East under its thumb until the sudden fall of its capital in the late 7th century. The formula of Assyria's approach can be summarized in two terms: state terrorism and collective punishment. Fear kept their rivals down for a long time, but it sure wasn't winning them any hearts and minds. So when in 612 BCE, their capital of Nineveh was finally brought down and sacked by a giant coalition, most people rejoiced. But this left a vacuum that would mostly be filled by the two main powers that had cooperated to lay Assyria low. One was Babylonia, whose culture and methods were somewhat similar to those of the Assyrians. The fate of the Jewish people, I think, is telling. Assyria deported the 10 tribes of Israel, who then became known as the Lost Tribes, since they are never heard of again. The Babylonians would deport lots of Jews, or proto-Jews too, but to its own capital region, where many would flourish. Where the Assyrians had utterly destroyed temples of conquered peoples, along with anything else, the Babylonians took away statues of their gods, perhaps officially for safekeeping, but, you know, also as collateral, in case their followers would misbehave. So the Babylonians could be just as ruthless as the Assyrians, but on average, I think they were slightly less severe. The other great power were the Medes. These were relatively new. Their rise was probably made possible precisely because the Assyrians, in typical fashion, had destroyed the dominant power in what is now Persia, namely Elam. With the Elamites no longer serving as a buffer, the Medes and other tribal peoples from Central Asia could quickly move in and subdue the other peoples around Iran. After they swallowed up a big chunk of the Assyrian Empire and its riches, they became rich and powerful. Tellingly, Ecbatana, once a smallish settlement in the rugged mountains of North Iran, would become their capital, and it was now quickly becoming a majestic city. With the wealth that was flowing to this formidable power center, the king of the Medes could strengthen his grip, not only on other peoples, but also on his own. And as we've seen many times already in this podcast, that is bound to create tensions. Like many other tribal peoples, the Medes didn't like to fall to the ground before their mortal leaders. They considered them first among equals, were only to be obeyed as long as they proved able to provide a satisfactory amount of loot. It was clear that their king was no longer content with that, however, and that he began to have the means to change things. So it seems they felt that the time had come for a change in leadership. The coup would be led by one of the tribal peoples that were subject to the Medes. These were the Persians, named after the region of Pars where they lived. By hook or by crook, their leader Cyrus became accepted as the king of Medes and Persians alike, and he made sure to reward the loyalty with all the loot that they could wish for. But this coup would be framed in a very colorful way. Even Herodotus picks it up. The king of the Medes, Astyages, had a dream in which his daughter urinated all over the world. So he goes to his soothsayers, obviously, and they inform him that his daughter was about to give birth to someone who would overpower the whole world, including him. So he decided his grandson had to die, a task that he would outsource to an underling called Harpagus. Of course, like in the tale of the hunter and Snow White, Harpagus couldn't find it in his heart to fulfill this dreadful command. He would make sure that the boy survived. But then Astyages somehow found out. His grandson was still alive and kicking. He decided he had to set an example. He had to punish his unfaithful servant. he gave a feast where he served the unwitting Harpagus the chopped up pieces of his own son. As soon as Harpagus had finished eating, he informed him with glee what he had just devoured by summoning forth the head of his boy. Harpagus, as you can imagine, was freaked out, but pretended to be humbled by the whole experience. He would bide his time. He worked really hard to win the king's trust again. And as a result, he still made a great career in the military, in effect becoming the chief commander of Astyages' troops. So when Cyrus's rebel forces were about to clash with those of his grandfather, on the other side, he would face the man who had rescued him and paid for that with his own son's life, supposedly. And now Harpagus's time had come. At a crucial moment, he would bring his troops over to Cyrus, giving Astyages his just deserts. Now, I don't know to what extent this story was fabricated on purpose. It can just have been a folktale that Herodotus overheard or something. But you'll have to admit, Cyrus would have loved to see it spread. It would show that he had been the rightful king of the Medes from the beginning, and that he had been in his right to overthrow Astyages. A story like that would surely make his reign more acceptable to the Medes, wouldn't it? Now that said, I don't think he would have needed it. His mother was a daughter of the Median king, who had married her out to his father, the Khan of the Persians, to cement their alliance. That in itself would make Cyrus a Median prince as well as a Persian one. It would be a foretaste of Cyrus's knack for propaganda. He would become one of the greatest conquerors of all time, but his main weapon, it seems, was not military in nature, but diplomatic. Just watch the way he conquered Babylon. By ingeniously making use of the internal divisions inside that mighty kingdom. The Babylonian ruler at the time was a very old man named Nabonidus. Not totally unlike Cyrus, he had taken power in a coup after the young king of Babylon died under murky conditions. He had first struck a deal with Cyrus, whose rebellion he must have seen as a wonderful opportunity to weaken the Medes, who were his main rivals after all. The Babylonians had even built a giant wall, known as the Median Wall, to keep these people out. Archaeologists have discovered a cylinder, celebrating the rise of Cyrus and predicting his victory over the Umanmanda, something that you might translate as the horde from who knows where. It is interesting to note that for many centuries, the people of Mesopotamia used that name, Umanmanda, as a catch-all phrase for barbarians from the steppes, sent by the gods to destroy civilizations that had gone astray. After fulfilling that task, the Umanmanda would themselves be destroyed by the gods. In this old Babylonian reading, the Medes were the Umanmanda, barbarians from the northeast. They'd been sent by their great god Marduk to destroy the hated Assyria. Now they sent Cyrus, Marduk would send Cyrus to get rid of the Umanmanda. However, once their common enemy would be gone, Cyrus was going to use that framing as Marduk's servant against Nabonidus. You see, Cyrus noticed that his old friend had a clear weakness. There was something strange about Nabonidus. Babylon, as any great city of the time, had a protector god, the already mentioned Marduk. And the king played a very important role in his cult. Perhaps most importantly, every year, during a religious festival, he had to pay homage to the god, grasping the hand of his statue. But Nabonidus neglected this crucial ritual for several years on end. That, of course, put many people off. They were convinced Marduk would not forgive this. And indeed, all sorts of problems, it seems, were popping up, perhaps some actively caused by Cyrus. Of course, the powerful priesthood of Marduk would say, "See, that's what happens." Still, Nabonidus wouldn't come home. So where was he? Somewhere far away, it seems, in an Arabian oasis, building a religious temple complex for another deity, a moon goddess called Sin. We are not entirely sure why. Perhaps he was just an eccentric. But there is a theory. It seems that his mother was a priestess of Sin, and that she had foretold Nabonidus would become king. And he therefore may have ascribed his unlikely fortunes to Sin, somewhat like a Constantine or Clovis attributed their key victories to the Christian god. Or it may really have been an attempt to undermine the Babylonian priesthood, who may have been opposed to this parvenu gaining power from the start. whatever his reasons, the predictable result would be that Nabonidus became very unpopular, and Cyrus would make full use of that, spreading the word that Babylon had lost the gods' favor, that it was all Nabonidus's fault, of course. And since Marduk had sent Cyrus to take care of the Umanmanda, who were now in his army, by the way, since he had become king of the Medes, he continued to present himself as the instrument of that god. Marduk had invited, nay, summoned him to free Babylonia from its unworthy ruler and make sure that he was worshipped properly once again. Seems to have worked, because Babylonia soon fell into Cyrus's hands like a ripe fruit. But although Cyrus makes it sound as if no blood was spilled and the gates of Babylon were magically opened before him, that is too rosy a picture. There would be blood. After his victory was assured, then the people of Babylon would of course welcome him in as a savior. To do otherwise would have been asking for catastrophe. Once the city was under control, the propaganda just continued. Not only did Cyrus make sure that Marduk was satisfied, he also sent home all the idols that Nabonidus had confiscated from the surroundings. This was a fantastic propaganda coup. In the eyes of their worshippers, these statues were probably equated with the gods themselves. The Babylonians probably explained the taking of these idols as safekeeping. You wouldn't want your gods to fall into the hands of these Persian barbarians, now would you? But it's doubtful whether that was convincing, because who would protect them and bless them if not their patron deity? Now Cyrus would put the lie to this Babylonian claim. Instead of harming the statues, he brought them home, presumably with celebrations and extra incense burnt in their honor. We can imagine the scenes of joy and relief, right? It's also worth noting that even before he marched into Babylon, Cyrus had conquered Lydia in present-day Turkey. That was the land of King Croesus, whose wealth had become proverbial. Wealth that would now fall into Cyrus's hands. According to the story, here too, it was his cunning that brought him victory. An early encounter with the Lydians had been indecisive, and at some point the weather was beginning to change, signaling the end of the campaign season. It was customary then that all the warring parties would send their men home, but against all protocol, Cyrus pushed on, and so he caught the Lydians by surprise, with their capital Sardis poorly defended. I guess you can say that from this moment on, the Persians also became a financial powerhouse, enabling them to buy influence. Story has it that the defeated King Croesus was treated kindly by Cyrus and even began to work for him as an advisor. But that, some historians have pointed out, would be unlikely. As long as the former king remained alive, he could serve as a rallying flag for a local opposition. The tale may well have been spread to show the clemency of Cyrus, so to convince others to come over to his camp. And it is perhaps telling that Cyrus's name, which must have sounded more like Kurash or Kurush, means he who humiliates his enemies, not he who forgives his foes. Personally, though, I think it would be smart to keep such people alive. This sort of advisor could be of immeasurable value. And perhaps it is true after all, for we know that the Greek's great hero, Themistocles at least, would make his way to the court of his erstwhile opponent Xerxes, Cyrus's grandson, who welcomed his old foe with open arms. And speaking of the Greeks, by overtaking the Lydian Empire, the Persians also became the overlords of the Ionian Greeks, which would lead to the fateful confrontations at Marathon, Thermopylae, Plataea, and Salamis. But I'm sure you're familiar with these events. We don't know how Cyrus died. Herodotus claims that it happened while he tried to attack the Massagetae, a steppe people led by a woman. At first, he would get the upper hand, through a ruse, typically, and it would be Croesus, the former king of Lydia, who would supposedly hand this trick to him. To set up a poorly protected camp with fat food and lots of wine, and then let these barbarians plunder it. They would not be used to wine and fat food. Once they were tipsy and full, Cyrus's men could fall upon them by surprise. It worked, and as a result, the son of the Amazon queen would be captured. But as he commits suicide while in custody, his mother would become so enraged that she attacks the Persians with all she has and manages to kill Cyrus. Now, this tale is not generally believed. Most likely, Herodotus wants to show that the Persians succumbed to hubris and were even defeated by a woman, which the Greeks would have found humiliating. Cyrus the Great has gone down in history as a merciful conqueror, but that is almost a contradiction in terms, and especially in this era. True, after the hated Assyrians and Babylonians, it probably made sense to present yourself as the antithesis to their cruel approach. The influential Babylonian priests were open to this, and so were the Jews. They had been deported from their homeland, and now Cyrus declared that the Babylonian exile was over, which explains why he gets such a good press in the Bible. He is the only non-Jew to be called the Messiah, anointed by God. Indeed, he claimed to be sent by Yahweh to free his people, just like he had supposedly been sent by Marduk to free Babylon. This was not good news for everyone. The Jews that did prefer to return to their promised land got to enforce their laws upon the local non-Jewish populace. These people, who had no friends in high places, got the short end of the stick, being robbed of their land and property and oppressed in many ways. It was a deportation in reverse, but still a deportation, with the same divide and rule purposes as those that Babylonia had. It's also easier to present yourself as a liberator when you come to take over some place from another oppressive power, than if you come to retake it after it has revolted against you. Whenever that happened, the Persians would show that they could be just as nasty as the Babylonians. And this would already become clear under Cyrus's son Cambyses, who became known as the Mad King. Cyrus had had two sons. He had decided that the older one, Cambyses, would be the heir, but his brother Bardia, to keep him happy and loyal, got a giant part of the empire that he could rule practically independently. He didn't even have to pay tax. But this arrangement wouldn't hold. As we've said already, Darius would claim that Cambyses was mad and killed Bardia, after which an impostor pretending to be Bardia took his place. As we said, this is perhaps the unlikeliest sounding part of the whole story that is carved on the rocks of Baestun, and the evidence would show that indeed it is utter nonsense. For starters, Cambyses proved to be no madman at all. He even captured Egypt in a way that seems almost an echo of how his father handled things. By finding important collaborators, in this case the leader of the Egyptian fleet, who came over to his side. Of course, he would be generously rewarded for this. According to the official story, Cambyses acted as a lunatic in Egypt, driving the local priests to madness when he stabbed a sacred Apis bull. He would also reportedly send thousands of his soldiers to their deaths in a crazy march through the desert. But then, a few thousand years later, archaeologists start digging. Turns out there are no indications of a lost army, and the Apis bull in question died a normal death. Cambyses ruled just like an exemplary Egyptian pharaoh, just like his father would have done in Babylon and other places. If anything, this shows that Cambyses was a more than capable king, I think. But he was probably also demanding more taxes and soldiers for his foreign campaigns. While he was away, something was stirring in the east of the empire, and it probably had to do with the same dynamic that had brought Cyrus to power. The khans and nobles had supported him against Astyages because the Medes were centralizing, taking their independence away, and raising taxes. Now Cambyses was doing the same thing. This gave his ambitious brother an opportunity to usurp his position. It seems that he had promised to waive taxes for years. How he would pay for that, you say? By confiscating the property of those who stood by his brother. As soon as Cambyses hears of this, he naturally prepares to go back and settle things. But then something happens. Cambyses somehow gets killed. We don't know how. Suspiciously, perhaps, Darius, who was his lands bearer at the time, remains very vague about it, merely saying that he died his own death. This may mean that he committed suicide or stabbed himself by accident. Perhaps he gets cut by his own lance or something and the wound gets infected. Perhaps it just means that he got what he had coming. Probably the noble commanders in his own retinue, among them Darius, were themselves unhappy about the king's centralizing tendencies. They may have decided to put a stop to this themselves. There was certainly in a position to have him murdered, and if word would get out that Cambyses had gone mad, then perhaps people would not ask too many questions about how he died exactly. That said, this is all speculation. It's perfectly possible that he died of natural causes. Now at that point, according to Cyrus's wishes, with Cambyses dead, it's Bardia that should have become king. He was no longer a rebel, and he shouldn't have bothered rebelling at all had he known this in advance. Surely, the right thing for Cambyses' loyalists was now to pledge their allegiance to him, right? Except, of course, that would be dangerous. Bardia could now see them as people who had opposed his claim to the throne. He could not trust them, and so their lives, let alone their careers, would be in jeopardy. Strange thing, but I've never seen any writer point that out. Perhaps it's too obvious to mention. But I think it explains why at that particular moment, Darius and some other generals decided to do something outrageous. They put together a high-level hit squad, and these seven generals then rode towards the king's camp, overawed the guards, perhaps thought they were coming to pledge their allegiance, and before anyone could stop them, they slayed the sorcerer, pretending to be the king. Except, of course, that I don't believe there was ever an imposter. So then, who have these assassins just killed? Guess the obvious reason why no one could reportedly tell that their king was not the real Bardia is because he was the real Bardia. But of course you couldn't say that because that would be lying, and it soon became plain what happened to people who lied. The assassins chose a leader among themselves, and this would be Darius, who claimed that it was thanks to the intervention of Mazda that he became king. And of course that they had done a brave thing, ridding the empire of this foul mage who had pretended to be their king. Not anyone was ready to accept this, of course. The Achaemenid line had been the only thing that kept the empire together. Now that it was broken, disintegration and civil war would inevitably follow. So in all corners of the empire, people felt that if there was ever a good time to retake their independence, it was now, and they naturally would rally behind the survivors of the old dynasties that the Persians had subjugated not that long ago. Or at least behind people who claimed to come from that line. Hence, the simultaneous arrival of the nine mysterious liar kings. Like the one pictured at Baestun as the man who lied by claiming to be the son of Nabonidus, and as such, the rightful king of Babylonia. Hilariously, there even appeared a rebel leader who claimed to be the real Bardia, who would now have faked his death on two occasions then. Now, this is less unusual than you might think. In the time of troubles in Russia, the murdered Tsar Dmitri also kept popping up, then supported by this group, then by another. You might even see a similarity with the constant reappearance of the hidden imam later, but that would be taking it too far, no doubt. Now, what I find tantalizing is that though it's possible that all these rebels were indeed imposters, as Darius would say, it's equally possible that at least some of them were who they claimed. For if Cyrus had truly been as merciful as his propaganda would suggest, he would have spared some of these princes, on the condition that they would collaborate with him and help legitimize his rule. Perhaps they felt that their allegiance had only been to Cyrus and his sons, and not to Darius, who tried to usurp them after all. Or, just as likely, they had simply been waiting for an opportunity like this to reclaim their throne. I already said that some historians doubt whether Cyrus would have been so merciful as he would have us believe, because as long as these former kings remained alive, they would remain a threat to him. In other words, they think that he ought to have killed them precisely to avoid what would happen after the death of Bardia. Darius would concur that mercy was a mistake. He was not going to repeat it. Quite the contrary, after he took down the liar kings one by one, he had them killed in horrific ways, impaling them in a place that was ironically named the Valley of Mercy. Note that this is strikingly similar to what happened at the end of the Roman Republic. Like Cyrus, Julius Caesar had a policy of forgiving his beaten enemies, so that they would be in his debt, and to convince others that it was wise to come over to him. But as everyone knows, Caesar eventually gets whacked by some of those that he forgave. And this would teach his successor Augustus the lesson that mercy apparently doesn't work. for as soon as he came to power, he started a massive proscription. No more Mr. Nice Guy. Likewise, with the rise of Darius, the days of Persian forgiveness were also over. Darius was under no illusions. His lack of pedigree would continue to haunt him. There was nothing he could do to change his heritage, except lie about it, of course. But he could ensure that his son would be part of the royal family. And he did this by marrying Cyrus's daughter, Atossa. Now, she is a fantastic example of just how crazy the royal family ties in ancient Persia could get. As the founder's daughter, she of course represented a lot of legitimacy. So her brother Cambyses, who realized that too, married her himself. Whoever got to marry Cyrus's daughter would automatically become a rival to his throne. And indeed, when her other brother Bardia felt that his time had now come, she was there on the spot and married him too. Or the lookalike who killed her brother, of course. At least, that's what multiple sources claim, but to be honest, many other authors don't even mention that marriage at all, so I'm not quite sure what to make of it. I should, of course, have left it out for that reason, but I just want it to be true, I suppose. Now, even if it's not, what is certain is that Atossa then goes on to wed Darius the Great, who without a doubt was responsible for the murder of at least one of her brothers, and maybe even two. Now, that didn't stop Atossa from sharing his bed, though she probably didn't have much of a choice in the matter. Darius would have many sons, but it was her boy, Xerxes, who then became crown prince. That may be testament to her influence, or perhaps not, since Xerxes was the grandson of Cyrus the Great and the first son born to Darius after he became king. So it was not that illogical that he would be the first in line to succeed his father. But whether Atossa played an active role in all this, or whether she was just passed on as a trophy, she would continually find herself in a position of great importance, first as princess, then as queen, and finally as queen mother. And she kept these pivotal roles during the reign of no less than five kings. So during the most crucial part of the Achaemenid era, she was the constant factor in the heart of the empire. Her power probably peaked under Xerxes, since by that point her experience would be unsurpassed, and that king's fate had always been intertwined with hers, so he had to trust her. But interestingly, this king of kings didn't often refer to his maternal lineage. Instead, he insisted that it was his formidable father who had deemed him worthy of kingship, and Ahura Mazda, of course. It shows to what extent the usurper Darius, a man who sorely lacked legitimacy himself, had come to redefine what legitimacy even meant at the end. It was he who started the tradition of claiming to act on behalf of the Lord of Light and Wisdom, a tradition that would live on under later kings. But just to be clear, that shouldn't make you think that the Achaemenids were Zoroastrians. Cyrus and Cambyses almost certainly weren't. As far as we know, they never even mentioned Mazda even once. And no Achaemenid king ever remarks on the prophet Zarathustra. It seems they never heard of him. So clearly, the religion that they practiced was not the semi-monotheistic Zoroastrianism that is named after that prophet. But what was Achaemenid religion like then? I think it's worth taking a small sidestep here and diving a little deeper into this. Religion, after all, is one of these things that keep resonating for a long time, and so one of the most enlightening things to study about ancient history. And this is certainly no exception. There was a lot of religious variety in Persia. Especially Elamite temples were prevalent, as the Persians identified with that old local culture. Mitra was also prominent, the savior god whose cult would become a hit in Rome and a rival to Christianity. And so was Anahita, the original patron deity of the Sasanians. Typical of their pragmatic instincts, the Persians never forced their beliefs on anyone else. But that didn't mean Darius would not claim to act on behalf of Ahura Mazda. He would frame his battles as contests between light and dark, or more precisely, between truth and untruth. There was no contradiction there. Middle Eastern cities had always fought in the name of their patron god, whom they saw as the center of the universe, but never tried to spread his cult. He was their god. This may remind you of a still existing world religion that has its roots in these ancient times. The old gods were always linked to one place, one people. That is the reason why the Jews could not rebuild the temple of Yahweh while they were banished from their holy land. In this period, key texts of the Old Testament were written within the boundaries of the Persian Empire. And although it's Cyrus who gave the Jews permission to return to Israel, it's under Darius that this resettling program really got underway. Some historians therefore believe that the God of the Old Testament is fancied after Ahura Mazda, a heavenly figure with strong moral convictions. Now, I don't know whether that is true, but perhaps it wouldn't be surprising if the Persians somehow served as an example. Depictions of gods often resembled those of the most powerful kings in the old days. And by facilitating the reconstruction of his temple and the reenactment of his law, the Persians were doing God's work. Indeed, Cyrus was hailed as a messiah. And whenever you come across a depiction of a Christian saint, you will still see the halo that comes from the far, the winged circle that the Persians used to show the divine aura that was supposed to emanate from any king blessed by Ahura Mazda. In later times, when the Zoroastrian priests, the Magi, became really powerful, they could use this idea to keep kings in check. If a king deviated from the right path, his charisma would supposedly leave him, and with that, his right to rule. Needless to say, that was not what Darius intended. He was probably the first to give these priests great responsibilities, but he will have had prosaic reasons for that, I'm sure. The Magi would drink a mysterious potion and then go into a trance. And while hallucinating, they could supposedly talk to the god, much like the priestesses at Delphi would talk to the god Apollo. And I imagine that in this case too, the interpreters generally pointed out that the god had said what his favorite human wanted to hear. After all, Mazda's central position, and that of his priests, still rested entirely on Darius's whims by that point. As servants of the Lord of Truth and Wisdom, the Magi were also ideally placed to guard all sorts of knowledge and make sure that the truth would not be contaminated by falsehoods. Just like they had to make sure that no human breath could befoul the holy fires. As we've seen in previous episodes, the obsession with purity, both in dogma and in ritual, remains a hallmark of Iranian religion to this day. I think it was worth making a small detour into Persian religion. Now it's high time to get back to our main story. At the time, the story of Darius rising to power may have looked like history repeating itself almost. Astyages had wanted to take power from his nobles, so he was deposed by Cyrus. Cambyses had tried to centralize and raise taxes, so his brother undercut him by alleviating the tax burden. Bardia took power from nobles who were insufficiently loyal to him, so he was then killed by those nobles. Time and again, kings wanted to centralize power in their own hands, and their barons wanted none of it. This may well have been the reason why Darius came to power in the first place. Now, sometimes, if I'm in a contrarian mood, I imagine that this is also just a motif of modern historians, no more provable than Herodotus's theories of hubris leading to the fall of empires. But historians have reasons to believe that this really is at the foundation of what happened. It appears, for instance, that the conspirators that killed Bardia had agreed among themselves that the king would from then on be a first among equals. The deal was that after Darius was installed as king, they could come see him at all times. Unless in the unlikely event that he was just getting intimate with a woman. To avoid any awkwardness, you just then came back a little later. Sounds polite and sensible enough, and who reads the fine print anyway, right? But one time, when one of Darius's partners in crime demanded an audience, he would be stopped by some servants. "The king is with a woman," they said. "You'll have to come back later." Now, maybe this was true, or maybe it was a ruse to get out of the agreement. Clearly, that was what this nobleman suspected, for he exploded in anger and badly mistreated the servant who had dared to stop him. When Darius heard of this, he was upset, it seems. But perhaps, given just how cunning this guy was, perhaps he had been waiting for something like this to happen all along. He may even have provoked it. He asked the other members of his famous hit squad whether they approved of this fellow's behavior. And they were quick to say no, 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 as they could also sense any other answer could be taken as proof of complicity. So now, with their implicit consent, Darius felt safe to make an example of this guy and wipe out practically his entire family. He could rest assured that from then on, no one would demand access to him anymore if he refused to grant an audience. Henceforth, the centralization would become unstoppable. Practically everyone who could in theory pose a threat to Darius was taken out in a giant purge, the result of which Tom Holland aptly compared to that at the end of the Roman Republic. Once that all the lions are dead, only the sheep remain. When the Roman Senate was purged of all ambitious and capable leaders, it automatically became a spineless stocking shop. Likewise, after the removal of the powerful lords and khans, Darius would be free to completely reorganize the Persian Empire, so as to prevent the tide from turning again in the foreseeable future. He was the kind of man who worried about the tedious technicalities most rulers have no patience for, like permits or tax policy. He was actually proud of how much taxes he could squeeze out of his people. Imagine a politician boasting about that these days. All this diligence gave him the nickname the Grocer. That was not meant as a compliment, but in my opinion, it was Darius's passion for the seemingly boring facets of statecraft that gave the Persian Empire its solid foundations. Instead of local kings with old pedigrees, Persian satraps were now sent out to rule all the different satrapies. They could more or less run their affairs as they wished, but they had to stay loyal and provide troops and treasure. To make sure that they stayed in line, they would be constantly observed from close by royal spies known as the eyes or ears of the king. Often, the satraps belonged to the royal family themselves, so that their legitimacy depended on the dynasty's survival anyway. And there were financial reasons for them to stay loyal to the crown too. Their private income came largely from large estates that were granted to them in other corners of the empire. So if they broke loose from the empire, they would lose these possessions in a heartbeat. In later years, the satrapies gradually became more or less hereditary, and some satraps became so rich that they could afford their own mercenary armies. It is this that enabled the civil war that we described in the last episode. But in the final decades of the empire, Artaxerxes III pressed the reset button yet again. He would wipe out all rivals, especially within his own family, and force the satraps to dismiss their private armies. As we said, it's not that Persia was in decline by the time it fell. It still rested in large measure on the foundations that were put in place by that visionary organizer, Darius the Great. To facilitate the suppression of further rebellions, he had spent a lot of effort on building and maintaining a one-of-a-kind road and communication system. It's striking, until very recently, ruling Iran was made very difficult because different corners of its mountain fortress are hard to connect and easy to defend. But it was a dynasty from Persia that put together the single best infrastructure in the ancient world, way superior to the Roman road system, for instance. This became a great tool in the hands of the central authorities. A system of passes was put in place, which entitled all categories of users to appropriate rations along the way. Meager for most, but extravagant for others. For the envoys of the king, fresh horses and supplies were waiting every so many miles, so that they could drive non-stop and at top speed. But news could travel even faster than a horse. There would be a network of beacons on top of mountains that could be used to convey messages. This must have looked like something out of the Lord of the Rings. You know, Gondor calls for aid. As a figure of speech, the king would be aware of uphand rebellions before a treasonous satrap could start assembling his army, so he would have ample time to prepare and call up reinforcements, a huge advantage. Besides that, These efficient highways could also quickly be crossed by royal armies. The only downside to that, perhaps, was that the same would be true for invading armies. Lucky for the Persians, these were hard to come by, as Persia was the biggest fish in the sea. But it is the Persian road system that allowed Alexander the Great to keep reinforcing his army with fresh recruits and supplies as he was marching to the eastern edges of the empire and beyond. Without these Persian roads, the impressive conquests of their nemesis would be almost inconceivable, I think. Traders could also use these roads, provided that they had the necessary permission, of course. The selling of permits must have provided a steady stream of extra income, which could compensate for the hefty cost of maintaining the caravanserais and the highway police that kept the roads safe from robbers. Trade would have flourished as never before, which in itself tends to raise prosperity levels, at least for an elite. Perhaps it's not so surprising that the Persians would appreciate the importance of mobility so much, given their nomadic roots. Indeed, they had always remained nomads at heart. As we've seen, this was reflected in their way of life, the organization of their government, their clothing, even in their religion, and perhaps most of all in their adherence to oath-keeping and to the truth in general. In the beginning of this episode, we asked what would happen if you truly treated lying as a capital crime. Well, it's been tried, and the result, it seems, is that the propagation of official lies would be turned into an art form, one that has not gone out of fashion ever since. Incredibly ironic, but not coincidental, I don't think. Oh, and one more thing. In case you are wondering why I didn't mention the things that Persia is most known for, namely the dramatic failed expeditions into Greece, well, fittingly, that is not mentioned in Persian records. The truth is apparently all that never happened. Of course, the flip side to that omerta is that if thousands of years later someone wanted to know about the hard gates and all that, they would be totally dependent on people like Herodotus, who is himself nicknamed the father of lies. Who would believe such a man? You might just as well watch the movie 300, I suppose. Enjoy the holidays, everyone. Bye.